Tonight on The Readout.
Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
White supremacists and right
like me to condemn?
White Proud supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
As we await a verdict in the Proud Boys trial, how January 6th continues to be a drag on the Republican Party, as their likely nominee, Donald Trump, continues to quite literally embrace insurrectionists. Also tonight, the sorry state of the right-wing Supreme Court majority and the questions their actions raise about the credibility of the court. And actor and comedian John Leguizamo will be here, right here on set with me to discuss his new series, Leguizamo Does America. Very, very excited about that. But we begin tonight still awaiting a verdict in the trial of five members of the far-right extremist group, the Proud Boys, for their role in the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. All five, including the group's former leader, Enrique Tarrio, are charged with seditious conspiracy. This is the group that Donald Trump famously told to stand back and stand by during the 2020 campaign. Along with other far-right groups like the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys descended on the nation's capital, heeding Trump's call for what he promised was going to be a wild time. The jury is expected to continue its deliberations on Monday. And while the Republican Party would like nothing more than to be able to move beyond the insurrection, the party's standard bearer is making that all but impossible, as he continues to make litigating the 2020 election and the big lie the main component of his 2024 campaign. Trump yet again pushed those debunked conspiracy theories last night at a campaign stop in New Hampshire. But probably more problematic for Republican Party leaders is his continued embrace of the January 6th insurrectionists themselves. Last night, he quite literally embraced one of the rioters who spent 160 days in prison for her actions that day. Trump told her to hang in there and that they were going to be okay.
What they say is so sad, what they've done to January 6th. So bad. Patriots, I'm going to hear the terrific woman.
It turns out that terrific woman, Mikki Larsen Olson, is a QAnon supporter who told NBC's Von Hilliard last year that she wants members of Congress, as well as former Vice President Mike Pence, to be executed for treason.
Those were domestic terrorists inside our Capitol, and I'm going to prove it on my trial.
Who are the domestic terrorists?
Our Congress. Our Congress that's been stealing elections for a very long time. Our country's been under admiralty law since 1871.
What should the punishment for those members of Congress be?
Execution for being traitors. That's what our Constitution demands. Our Constitution demands that traitors in our nation are executed. And that's what should happen to each and every person that hijacked the voice of we the people.
Is that something that you see actually happening?
Yes.
That's Trump's wonderful woman. And let's not forget that Trump has also claimed that he might pardon those charged in the insurrection if he reclaims the presidency. He even went so far as to record a song with some of the insurrectionists who are still incarcerated awaiting trial. That song is now being used as part of his campaign events. While most Republicans remain silent about Trump's continued adoration for this group, recently ousted Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney tweeted this warning to her former colleagues. Trump is embracing a J6 defendant who called for the execution of members of Congress. To elected Republicans who have endorsed him, you are endorsing his conduct on January 6th and every day since. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Joining me now is Congressman Eric Swalwell of California, a member of the House Judiciary and Homeland Security Committees, and Harry Littman, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General, senior legal affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and host of the Talking Feds podcast. Thank you both for being here, Congressman. I will start with you. Your reaction to Donald Trump literally embracing a QAnon-supporting insurrectionist who wanted people like yourself to be executed.
Joy, these are the foot soldiers of MAGA Nation, and they're doing exactly what Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson, and the MAGA Nation want them to do, which is to carry out violence in their name. And they try and be cute about it by, you know, saying stand back, stand by. But in all of their signaling, they are telegraphing that they want violence because they refuse to condemn the violence. And so, you know, the sedition charge here against the Proud Boys leader is likely, and I'll leave it to the jury, is likely to stick because the aim of the violence they carried out was to try and overthrow the government that was counting the votes. And so, Joy, you know, it's also, as we step back and look at accountability for January 6th, you know, the Department of Justice can play their part. But if the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, is going to continue to meet with January 6th, you know, he met with Ashley Babbitt's family recently, we just learned today, and allow his members to go to the January 6th jail, that's just a green light for more violence to be carried out in the name of MAGA Nation.
Seems so. Harry Lipman, let's go to this trial, because I wonder if it surprised you that they have not reached a verdict as yet and that they are going to have to continue deliberating. What does that tell you as a former prosecutor?
I would say not a lot yet. So it's been 2 days after a trial of some 4 months with 5 defendants, 9 different charges. I think any jury that's carefully sifting through the individual charges would have taken about this amount of time at a minimum. The congressman has been a prosecutor, and he might probably concur. 3 days, 4 days, that seems normal. You start to really bite your nails at the 5 or 6 day mark. So I don't think this is anything unusual or surprising so far.
Congressman, it sounds like you were agreeing.
Yeah. Again, you know, very rarely would they come back so swiftly. But, you know, that's 45 different counts if you break it out with 5 defendants and 9 charges. And a diligent, responsible jury will give every defendant for each charge, the benefit of the doubt, which is, you know, that the state has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that takes time. So not much you can read in to hear. I would be interested to know what types of questions are coming back. Yeah. From the jury, if any at all. But again, this seems pretty standard.
Harry, let me go back to you on this, because so what we do know is that these are some of the texts that we saw going from Oath Keepers who were connected to other far right groups, the Three Percenters and others. So Kelly Meigs, who was the leader of the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, which is one of the other main groups, militia, started reaching out to allies and other far right organizations. The militia had sought to create what prosecutors referred to as an alliance with the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters. Meigs told a member of the Three Percenters he had made contact with the Proud Boys and called them a force multiplier. There is video here that you will see that shows Enrique Tarrio, a documentary filmmaker, took this video. This is the garage meeting on January 5th. The video included a portion in which you could hear someone saying, "It's inevitable. It's going to happen. We just have to do it strong and fast." This video includes Stuart Rhodes, Enrique Tarrio, Kelly Sorrell, a lawyer for the Oath Keepers, Bianca Gracia, who's the leader of Latinos for Trump, which also Enrique Tarrio used to be the leader of, Joshua Macias, who helped to run a group called Vets for Trump. We know that Tarrio sent a document saying 1776 returns, and it outlined a January 6th style attack. According to the Department of Justice, the plan was to occupy a few crucial buildings in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, including House and Senate office buildings outside the Capitol, with as many people as possible to show our politicians we're in charge. We know that several Oath Keepers were convicted of seditious conspiracy. Do their convictions tell us anything about this trial, since they were working so closely together?
Well, it's a really interesting and important point, Joy. And there's this amoeba-like quality of these groups. Even the woman that Trump embraced, she's no longer QAnon. She has got a new group. We see this in the international realm as well, where it's very hard for the government to kind of keep up, because a trial is a snapshot of criminality when it happened. The theory here of the government, and seditious conspiracy is always a hard charge to prove, is that what the Proud Boys were and wanted to be was the spear going forward, because their numbers wouldn't permit the attack on their own. So they did need to combine, including with people who just got caught up in the moment. So yes, that garage video I found really alarming, specifically not just for the charges themselves in January 6th, but for what it portends of the continuing kind of evolution and new emergence of groups in different forms.
Right. And, you know, Congressman, the only group that was called out specifically by Trump, and he was asked to condemn far right groups and condemn white nationalist groups, the Proud Boys were named. He said, "Stand back, stand by." We know there was an immediate response. They changed their logo to add "stand back and stand by." They responded to him on social media that sort of interaction wasn't direct, but it definitely was. They directly felt he was talking to them. It just, as you look at it, both as a member of Congress and also as a former prosecutor, does that that tell you that it would be very difficult to convict Oath Keepers for seditious conspiracy, but not the group that was literally told to stand back and stand by?
Again, Joy, I'll leave it to the jury. This is their job. But it looks like, you know, they may have worn, you know, different colors that day, but they were all essentially on the same team and they had the same charge. But to the larger picture here, I do believe that what the American people are looking at, they're grateful that the Department of Justice continues to aggressively prosecute these cases. But January 6th and who was responsible, I put it in two camps. You had the hustle and you had the muscle. And the muscle are the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the groups that went in there committed to carrying out violence, and they have been aggressively prosecuted. The country now, though, is asking, when is the hustle going to be responsible? And the hustle is Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, the people who spun up, incited, inspired, and aimed the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers at the Capitol. And I think for complete justice to happen, the hustle and the muscle need to be, you know, completely held accountable.
Which brings me back to you, Harry Littman, because we know that Mike Pence has now finally is submitted to questions before the grand jury, for Jack Smith's grand jury. And it does seem, you know, he was the person that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and 3%ers were directing their force at, trying to push him to do a very specific thing and take the election for Donald Trump. What does his questioning tell you about the state of Jack Smith's investigation, given that, right, all of the grunts are facing prosecution, but Donald Trump so far has walked away and is out campaigning like nothing's happened?
First, the fact of it. Talk about law without fear or favor. You know, sometimes these events are so close, it's hard to appreciate. It's kind of breathtaking. The vice president of the United States went to the grand jury to testify against the president he served in a criminal investigation. And by the way, Smith did it. He didn't even wait for Trump to try to go to the Supreme Court. Just as soon as it happened, he was yanked the next morning into the grand jury. That's one. Two, it was a whole day of testimony. We know some of the things that are vivid and does do a lot for Smith in terms of the conversations we heard about, especially the vicious one of January 6th itself. But they were talking, they were having weekly lunches from the time of the election, and there could be a lot more there. Finally, it's very important that he did it just to lock Pence in. It almost doesn't matter if Pence was kind of bobbing and weaving, because it says he wants that testimony in the can. And that to me says they're little pieces to tie up. But we are very near the end of the day if you're bringing the vice president in. That is not a preliminary move. I think it says that at least one, and there are a cluster of them, January 6th prosecutions is really about ready to come to market.
As the great Rachel Maddow would say, watch this space. Congressman Eric Swalwell, Harry Littman, thank you both very much. Up next on The Readout, Supreme Court in crisis. Questions about the court's credibility and ethical standards continue to pile up as Chief Justice John Roberts refuses to testify before Congress. The Readout continues after this. The drip, drip, drip of Supreme Court scandal continues. Let's just tick off the controversy, shall we? Remember when Justice Clarence Thomas said his billionaire close friend, Nazi paraphernalia collector, and mother's home purchaser, Harlan Crow, had no business before the Supreme Court? Well, according to Bloomberg News, surprise, that's not true. The Supreme Court did, in fact, review at least one matter involving a Crow-linked firm. Justice Thomas did not recuse himself from the 2004 appeals case. And then we have Justice Neil Gorsuch, who, according to Politico, sold a property he owned to the head of a major law firm with business before the Supreme Court. But what's a story about SCOTUS disgrace without a mention of Brett Kavanaugh? A damning new report by The Guardian says serious omissions were swept under the rug in the Republican-led Senate investigation that claimed to exonerate Kavanaugh of accusations he sexually assaulted Christine Blasey Ford, as well as potential misconduct against other women decades ago. The 2018 investigation prominently claimed to debunk the allegations of Deborah Ramirez, who said Kavanaugh exposed himself to her at a party, saying it was a case of mistaken identity. Turns out the mistaken identity claim was sent to the Judiciary Committee by an attorney named Joseph Smith, according to a non-redacted copy of a 2018 email obtained by The Guardian. Smith, who's also a member of the Federalist Society, wrote in that email that he was in a class behind Kavanaugh and Ramirez and believed Ramirez was likely mistaken in identifying Kavanaugh. Instead, Smith said it was a fellow classmate named Jack Maxey, who was a member of Kavanaugh's fraternity. But in an interview with The Guardian, Maxey confirmed that he was still a senior in high school at the time of the alleged incident and said he had never been contacted by any of the Republican staffers who were conducting the investigation. Joining me now is Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Senator, it seems to me that from the very beginning, Brett Kavanaugh's tenure on the court, his accession to the court, has been questionable because I don't think anyone who paid attention thought there was a thorough investigation of Christine Blasey Ford and other women's allegations. With this new information, plus all the other scandals, should there and will there be a specific investigation into misconduct, potential misconduct, by Kavanaugh?
Well, with regard to Justice Kavanaugh, it was very contentious, as you know, and the FBI's so-called second investigation, we concluded, I certainly did, that it was totally inadequate because, from what you're saying, they did not interview all of the witnesses, including, by the way, Dr. Ford. So going forward, my focus and that of the committee at this point is to require that the Supreme Court itself have some procedures for when there is misconduct within the court. And that's part of the bill that would require stronger recusal requirements for the justices, as well as requiring them to adopt the code of ethics. So there is a bill that would do those things. And that is the hearing that the Supreme Court Justice Roberts has declined to come and join us at. However, Joy, we are going to go forward because this is important. Disclosure is important, and making sure that the Supreme Court is held to the highest standards. They should at least have a code of ethics that all the other judicial the judges have. It's really totally unacceptable that the Supreme Court seems to think that they don't have to abide by these requirements.
But the question, I mean, the Senate Judiciary Committee has an independent authority to investigate. They are under the purview of the Judiciary Committee. And Justice Roberts raised separation of powers questions and said he wouldn't come in. However, we still don't know who paid off $700,000 in Brett Kavanaugh's sort of magically disappearing debts. We still don't know the full extent of the Crow relationship financially with Clarence Thomas. We still don't know the extent to which Clarence Thomas's wife has been involved in insurrection and other political endeavors. We still don't know about Justice Roberts' wife, who apparently took in $10 million in fees as a headhunter in an elite law firm, according to whistleblower documents. And then there's also Gorsuch. They're selling and buying properties from people with business before the court. They are acting like a little tin pot elite that can do whatever they want. They have no ethical boundaries, and yet they're whining and complaining, including Alito, that no one trusts them and that no one likes them. Shouldn't the Senate Judiciary Committee investigate them specifically for their misconduct, not just to get a new ethics rules, but their misconduct?
Whether or not
potential, I should say.
Whether or not we're going to go down that road as we are proceeding to require them to have a code of ethics, whether or not the committee wants to do the kinds of investigation, I frankly don't know, because what we want is for them to at least have a code of ethics so that these kinds of behaviors, these kinds of deals are at least disclosed to the American public. And I think what that leads to is a desire for court reform, and that we do not have a balanced court. We have a majority that is extremist. And my hope is that we will begin to really push for example, increasing the number of justices on the court and all the other things that I think will change the way this court operates.
I think I'm sorry, finish your sentence.
Yes. There are different ways that we can proceed. I've been wanting to get to court reform for quite a few years now. And yeah. I think all of this kind of drip, drip, drip that you're talking about means that I think there will be growing support for the kinds of changes that will reform the way this court operates. And that's where I'm going.
Thank you, Senator Mazie Hirono. Always appreciate you being here. Thank you. Joining me now. Let's bring in Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent for The Nation. I mean, I could do seven more minutes of potential ethical scandals, Ellie. I mean, the conduct by Clarence Thomas could be criminal. The conduct by Kavanaugh back during that time could have been criminal. The FBI did a pretend investigation of him. He's sitting on the court judging whether we can have the rights over our own bodies, and he might have misused the bodies of women. To me, they seem completely out of the bounds of ethics, and they don't care.
And Hirono just said something that I think is a problem with the Democratic Party's response to this entire ethical catastrophe, right? And she said it, right? She was like, we're hoping the Supreme Court adopts for itself a code of ethics. Why are we leaving it up to them? Like, what more does the Supreme Court have to do to prove that it is incapable of policing itself? At this point, we are in a world where the Supreme Court's like, oh, we can totally police. Look, we saw a mouse in our house and we caught it. No, you idiot. If you saw the mouse, that means you've got 10 in the walls and you need to burn it with fire. OK, like it is time to send in the cats. It is time to send in the owls. It is time to send in independent oversight over the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court does not have a choice with. And so the thing that I wanted Senator Hirono to say, that I want Senator Durbin to say, that I want anybody in Congress to say, is to use Congress's congressional authority over the power of the purse to bring these justices to heel. It is Congress that controls Supreme Court funding. Now, we have seen, because of some of the drip, drip, drip of scandals that you mentioned, Joy, we have seen that these nine people are probably able to live without their government salaries, right? Yeah. Between their land deals and their book deals and their laundering money through their spouses, they probably don't need their government salaries, right? But I bet they like having a courthouse. I bet they like having clerks. I bet they like having free Westlaw access. I know they like having taxpayer-funded security details, right? And if Congress starts taking those away, if Congress puts the stick to these people and starts taking away some of their perks and some of their privileges, then I bet you the Supreme Court would see the virtue in submitting to independent ethics oversight. It is that or the highway. This ridiculousness of the Supreme Court to police itself has already been proven to be false and unable for these justices to do.
Well, the other branch of government that could step in is, of course, the executive branch, namely the Justice Department. I mean, the conduct by Clarence Thomas is potentially criminal. I've heard not a peep and not a whit of a chance that he might be investigated for that misconduct. It's starting to feel like these nine people, and it's really six of them who've been doing just the strangest things, or at least four or five of them, are above the law. Because if the Justice Department won't do it, and the Congress won't do it, that means that they are above the law, right?
I do not know what Chris Wray has to not do to get fired, right? Like, I don't know what other level of incompetence we need to see from FBI Director Christopher Wray for him to lose his job. He is the one who botched, and I would argue, covered up the Brett Kavanaugh investigation. He is the one who had the opportunity to hear all of these senatorial complaints. He's the one who went with like, oh, it was somebody else's exposed genitalia. It wasn't Brett Kavanaugh. He's the one who believed that. Why does he still have a job? Nobody can answer that question for me. So absolutely, the Justice Department, which Chris Wray works for, needs to get involved and at least figure out how they completely messed up an investigation into Brett Kavanaugh. They need to do something about investigating Clarence Thomas. They need to do something, and they won't. And the thing that really gets under, in case you haven't figured it out, the thing that really gets under my skin, Joy, is that they won't tell me why. They won't tell me why they won't do this. In 2018, speaking of Brett Kavanaugh, when the Democrats were running to blue wave the House, Nancy Pelosi promised me that there would be a real investigation into the Brett Kavanaugh allegations, and that never happened, and nobody told us why. So, like, just at some point, you have to, like, understand that these people, yes, they are operating above the law because nobody in law enforcement tries to stop them. Yeah. We should at least try to stop them.
Yeah, indeed. I think you're going to get a lot of amens for that. Having two out of nine credibly accused either sexual harassers or potential sexual assaulters judge whether women can control their own bodies, including in cases of rape and incest, is a scandal in and of itself. to say nothing of all the financial scandals. Ellie Mastal, always, thank you very much. Still ahead, corporations are people, except apparently in Florida, where Ron DeSantis' ongoing feud with Disney is running afoul of some prickly free speech issues. I will explain in a sec. While Ron DeSantis has spent the week gallivanting overseas as part of his pre-presidential run, back home in Florida, he is in some hot water, facing a blistering lawsuit from Disney. The entertainment giant slammed the governor for taking away their self-governing privileges, calling it a targeted campaign of government retaliation orchestrated at every step by Governor DeSantis as punishment for Disney's protected speech. DeSantis brushed off these claims yesterday while in Jerusalem.
They're upset because they're actually having to live by the same rules as everybody else. They don't want to have to pay the same taxes as everybody else, and they want to be able to control things without proper oversight, whereas every other Floridian has to have this type of oversight, all Florida businesses. So it's a little bit much to be complaining about that. I don't think the suit has merit. I think it's political.
Which is quite the argument, especially since DeSantis has previously bragged that the whole reason he started a war with Mickey Mouse in the first place was because the company spoke out against his Don't Say Gay law. Here's what he said right before he signed the measure revoking Disney's special governing status last year. Take a listen.
Incredibly, they say, we are going to work to repeal parents' rights in Florida. And I'm just thinking to myself, you're a corporation based in Burbank, California. And you're going to marshal your economic might to attack the parents of my state? We view that as a provocation, and we're going to fight back against that.
Well, seems pretty cut and dried to me. But DeSantis's war against free speech doesn't end there. New reporting today says Florida officials are threatening to revoke the teaching license of a Tallahassee school superintendent who has also criticized DeSantis. One must not question the diminutive dear leader. Joining me now is Juanita Tolliver, MSNBC political analyst and co-host of the What a Day podcast, and Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large of The Bulwark and MSNBC contributor. Juanita, it appears that the one rule in Florida is that you must not ever disagree with DeSantis.
Bow down, and bow down publicly is what he wants. Yeah. And I feel like every day he's stepping further and further into that moniker of fascist DeSantis. Mm-hmm. Like, he's showing all these authoritarian behaviors, but what's sickening about the Tallahassee elected official is that he has his minions out there monitoring individuals, yes, monitoring local elected officials, reporting back, because this is all based on one person reporting from an extremist group known as Moms for Liberty.
Yeah, and so basically, Charlie, he is trying to force not just companies, but individuals, yeah, to do exactly what he says when he says it, or he will use the government to punish you. That's literally a violation of the First Amendment. Let me quote the great Ted, yeah, Boutros, the First Amendment attorney, a brilliant attorney, who said, Disney has put together a powerful complaint. Disney's First Amendment arguments are extremely strong. DeSantis has admitted, indeed bragged about retaliating against Disney to punish it for speech on an issue of public concern and importance. That is a classic First Amendment violation. I didn't go to law school, Charlie, but that sounds pretty cut and dry to me.
You know, Ron DeSantis wanted to fight with Disney. Well, now he's got one, but this has really become a political quagmire. I have to tell you, this is one of those issues that makes my head explode, because it's not just bad on constitutional law. It's just terrible politics. I mean, if you wrote a screenplay of a politician who wanted to be a bully and picking the wrong target, it would be about somebody to say, let's go after the happiest place on earth. Let's launch this campaign of retaliation against Mickey Mouse, of all people. But that lawsuit is a real problem for him, because he has been living very much online, and he's about, mm-hmm, to find out that the kinds of things that get people like Christopher Rufo and his Twitter minions excited is not going to play the same way in a federal court, especially when there are so many quotes and there are so many sound bites like the one you played, where he basically says, yes, this is what I'm doing. I am retaliating against you for things that you said, for your criticism of me. It's right there. It's not going to go well for him at all.
And all I can picture is Mickey Mouse going, enough! Enough, Ron DeSantis! I've had enough! And winning! He's getting beat by a mouse! Okay, let's move on, because Florida is not just the unhappiest place on earth for teachers and anybody who's not DeSantis' toady. Apparently, it's the unhappiest place on earth for Dwayne Wade. Yes. Take a listen.
that's another reason why I don't live in that state. A lot of people don't know that. I have to make decisions for my family, not just personal, individual decisions. I mean, obviously, the taxes is great. You know, having Wade County is great. But my family would not be accepted or feel comfortable there. So that's one of the reasons why I don't live there.
Juanita, Governor DeSantis's anti-gay, anti-trans policies drove Dwayne Wade out of Wade County, drove him out of Florida.
He is Florida, right? He is beloved, and he loves the community, and they love him back. But the reality is, he knows that he has to protect Zaya. He has to protect his daughter. And so prioritizing her needs as a trans youth who might want to seek gender-affirming care, for example, which is banned in Florida, who might want to talk about her gender identity at school, which is banned in Florida, is the right move. But sadly, that's not a move a lot of parents can make. And not just in Florida. I'm thinking about Texas. I'm thinking about Montana. I'm thinking about all the other states where these anti-trans bills are being passed, which we know will cause irreparable damage and harm to trans people and LGBTQ people writ large.
You know, Charlie, I don't understand the politics of it. I'm being honest. As somebody who worked in campaigns for a hot minute, being cruel and driving Dwayne Wade out of your state and maybe triggering him to campaign against you in a presidential election. Marjorie Taylor Greene going after Randy Weingarten and saying she's not a real mom because she's a stepmom and because she's LGBTQ. How is that a good argument? Michael Steele destroyed her today saying, oh, sorry, but Jesus' daddy was also a step-parent.
Come on.
To me, I don't understand who this appeals to other than mean trolls who are already going to vote for you.
So this is what you get for trapping yourself in your own hermetically sealed ideological bubble. You're talking to yourself. You are listening to your own echo chamber because this plays within that narrow world. And everybody on the outside is saying, what are you saying? Why is Marjorie Taylor Greene questioning motherhood of others? They've gotten out of the habit of thinking about how to persuade normal Americans. And it is all about throwing red meat, hitting the buttons, getting that dopamine hit. But, you know, with Ron DeSantis, I mean, he's hit the trifecta here. I think he's going to lose in court. I think the fight with Disney is politically damaging. And then the Dwayne Wade, episode also reminds us of the possible economic fallout from this. Mm-hmm. All Disney or any other major company has to do is say, you know, we're considering moving some of our thousands of dollars and tens of millions of actually billions of dollars in economic impact out of the state of Florida. Ron DeSantis is dead. And this is something that had he thought this through, if he was actually a chess player, he might have thought, if you take on one of the most popular corporations in America, who happens to be one of the economic engines of your state and one of your state's biggest employers, bad things are going to happen in court, in the court of public opinion, and possibly economically. And we're seeing that playing out right now.
And it feels like they're pushing women away everywhere, beating up teachers, beating up moms, beating up Disney, beating up cruise companies. Who are they attracting, Juanita?
Definitely not women, definitely not young people, definitely not LGBTQ people, definitely not black people, right?
Hello.
Like the attacks have hit across demographics. And I think the reality is, though, DeSantis isn't going to let up. He's going to double down on this because he's trying to win a primary, remember?
Right.
And this is the red meat that you and Charlie just described that they want more of. Disney is his calling card, win or lose that case.
Yeah.
That's what gave him a national brand and recognition and what he's going to continue to fundraise off of.
You can't out-Trump Trump. Nobody is going to buy a fake version when the real version is also running. Juanita Tolliver, Charlie Sykes, thank you both very much. Coming up, actor and comedian John Leguizamo joins me to talk about his new MSNBC series, Leguizamo Does America. Stay right there. In MSNBC's new six-part series, Leguizamo Does America, actor, comedian, and activist John Leguizamo takes viewers on a journey of America's rich Latino heritage, with each episode focusing on a different location. Last week, Leguizamo tackled politics in my former state, Florida, with Cuban-American writer and activist Carmen Palaez.
After the year 2000, support for Democratic presidential candidates in Miami steadily increased. But in 2020, that support took a nosedive. So what's really going on here? Is this a permanent shift to the right, or will Democrats regain that success they once had? Why do you think Obama was electric,
was
galvanizing?
He came down here.
Mm.
And he spoke. And he wasn't
came
afraid
down
to,
here.
Yes. And he wasn't afraid to talk
That's
to people.
That's the secret sauce. That's the mojo. The mojo.
The mojo's listening.
It's the AOC Beto method of knock on Latino people's doors, come to their hometown, talk about their issues, and you win us over.
For this week's episode, premiering Sunday, Leguizamo comes to Washington, D.C. to explore Latino representation in American government right here in the U.S. Capitol. And joining me now is John Leguizamo, host of Leguizamo Does America. It is so exciting to have you here.
Oh, Joy, thank you for having me. What a blast.
I apologize for fangirling out when I met you earlier
likewise,
today.
Likewise.
I'm a huge fan. So let me talk about this. I used to live in Miami, I think I told you earlier, and I also used to live in Denver, Colorado. To me, these were such different Latino communities.
Right, true.
But what are the commonalities? What are the differences? Yeah. And I mean, Miami is such a specific culture.
It is. And what's interesting to me is that I feel like there's this myth that Latin people are fighting against each other in different groups. I don't believe that exists. I think we have differences, but the similarities are much bigger. That's what I found going through the show across the country. I felt like the commonality of language, mm-hmm. religion, culture, similar foods, similar music. We all love each other's music. That's right. Where we all get down.
Yeah.
So we love each other's music.
Yeah.
And I think that brings commonality. Yeah, of course, you got your differences. In Florida, you got a right-wing Cuban faction. But you also have very conservative Latinos in Texas that sometimes can easily be swayed to Republicans because they're anti-abortion and homophobic. But I think the most important thing is you got to do the Bernie thing. Get Latin consultants. Mm-hmm. And then find out what we want, what we need, and come talk to us, knock on our doors, and we'll flip your way.
Do you think that people, let me play one thing.
Yeah.
This is Cuban-American actor and writer, and this is Carmen Palaez talking about the thing that when I was in South Florida, this is what you heard about a lot of from a lot of people, the fear of socialism. Take a listen.
Yes, yes.
How can we make your life in this country and your transition from a socialist government to a democratic government, how can we make that easier? And I think that's where we fail. Because mm-hmm. we don't talk to people because we're afraid that we're going to be called communists and socialists the minute we knock on the door.
Right, right.
If we talk to them, we got them.
I think, is there an issue with a lot of people on the political side not understanding where people are coming from really influences their politics, right? People who come from Cuba, obviously, having real radar. If you're coming from Venezuela.
And Colombians now are easily triggered because of what's happening in Venezuela. They're triggered by the word socialism as well.
Absolutely.
So the Republicans knew when Trump was running for office. That's how they got Florida. They went to our Spanish radio stations.
Yep.
They went on WhatsApp in Arizona and in Florida, and they used the trigger words of socialism, communism, authoritarianism. But you have to go in there and educate them that you're not talking, you're not changing everything to socialism. You're a Democratic president who has Democratic values, and you're just trying to get people fed and get people services. That's it. You know, you got to be careful.
I think for Democrats on the Democratic side, there is this sort of constant trying. People will say some people, they're trying to pander. They're trying to figure out how to like relate to the Latino community. And they'll do things like, say, Latinx.
Right.
Do people that you know, friends of yours, family, do they like the term Latinx? Or are they like, whoa, please stop?
I don't know. People are getting triggered by Latinx.
Yeah.
I don't even know why. Like young people, old people, deaf, old people don't even want to change nothing.
Yeah.
Don't change anything for me.
Yeah.
I like every way everything is. Leave it alone. Don't touch it. Don't put your X on things. I love Latinx.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like you're superheroes, like the X-Men.
It does.
It's inclusive. It doesn't sound misogynistic or keeping women out. It's also inclusive of LGBTQ+. I love it all.
Yeah. What are we going to learn about D.C.? Because this is one Latino community that I don't think a lot of people know that much about.
Right. I thought it was always like a large Puerto Rican. I knew that because this is one of my touring spots.
Yeah.
It was a large Puerto Rican population, but I didn't know there was a huge Salvadorian Central American population.
Oh.
Huge.
Yeah.
And we went to the neighborhood and I didn't realize there were huge riots here in the 70s because of police brutality against Latinx. There, I used it again. Latinx, get over it. And they had a fight for respect from the police and to have Latin policemen so that could talk to people. So, yeah, I didn't know this about D.C. And then you got an amazing restaurant, Cielo, Latin Michelin star restaurant.
Okay.
There's a lot going on here in D.C. that's beautiful, Latinx. Gala Theater that creates a space for immigrant children who are being bullied at school, feel less than, and here they flower.
Yeah.
They're nurtured. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful things going on.
Well, I like the X, too, because it gives me Wakanda forever. You know, the religious Wakanda movie is bringing the black and Latino people together, the Black Tino Revolution. John Leguizamo, You're great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're amazing.
Thank you very much. Well, be sure to catch the new episode of Leguizamo Does America Sunday, 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on MSNBC and streaming on Peacock. It is really good. I've gotten texts about how great it is.
Oh, so good, good. I'm glad you dig it.
Thank you. And coming up.
A long, long time ago. Something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
The South Korean president bringing down the White House with American pie was pretty spectacular. But the question is, did he win the week? Stay right there. Well, we made it to the end of the week, my friends, which means it's time to play our favorite game. Aha! Who won the week? And today I am seizing control of the entire segment and declaring my tie to Who Won the Week contestants, and they both won the week equally. My first Who Won the Week, three African-American quarterbacks, three black quarterbacks for the first time in NFL history, drafted in the first round of the NFL draft. Bryce Young drafted number one by the Carolina Panthers, the Heisman Trophy winner out of Alabama. C.J. Stroud drafted by the Houston Texans out of Ohio State. And Anthony Richardson, who was drafted number four by the Indianapolis Colts from the University of Florida. Three black quarterbacks. Wow, that NFL has come quite a long way. But my other Who Won the Week is the great Jamie Raskin. He has been on this show. He is a great guy. He is heroic, and he's also been heroically battling cancer. And look at this. Look at this video. He got the ringing bell that shows that he has completed his chemotherapy for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There he is. He's ringing the bell at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital's Lombard Comprehensive Cancer Center. All the best to the great Jamie Raskin and to everybody at that wonderful hospital. And that is tonight's readout.